Hello, everybody. My name's Charisse. I'm in recovery. And about 10 days ago, I got a text from Dave and led to a phone call with Chris. And he asked me if I'd be willing to fill in for somebody who couldn't speak on Sunday morning on the 12th step for 20 minutes. And I said, if I'm not the keynote speaker, forget it. I don't want to do anything else. And then I said, one of my friends likes to say, when they're at a funeral, they want to be the corpse, and when they're at a wedding, they want to be the bride. And I really just shared that with them on that call, Chris, on that call, and I just love that. I just think it's so funny. Chris mentioned, or maybe it was Todd, I don't know, I came into Al-Anon in 1986, and my story is a little of a few fellowships. I was first in AA for 6 months prior to being led to Al-Anon, and I was so obsessed with this, and I'm from the Hudson Valley in New York, about an hour north of New York City, and before, I know everybody from New York thinks they're so much better than everybody else. I just want you to all to know that I realize I'm only a little bit better than the rest of you, okay? my sponsor in AA, as we were going into a Tuesday night meeting, I didn't even know there was an Al-Anon meeting there, but I was so obsessed with this individual in my life. They literally pushed me in this door where there was a few women sitting, said, this is Karen, and he said to Karen, they need you, and he pulled the door shut, and he walked down the hall to the AA meeting, and that was my introduction to Al-Anon. Obviously, that was a previous life. I'll share an experience that was really an early experience, one of my earlier memories in Al-Anon. I was probably in about maybe 6 weeks, maybe 2 months, and I was sharing, and this woman in the meeting interrupted me, like mid-sentence, and I'm like, and she said, excuse me, but we focus on ourselves in here. And I was like, oh, I just wanted to crawl under the table because I had no idea how outwardly focused I was and how obsessed I was with this individual and how it's all I was talking about. So that was a really early experience in Al-Anon that really kind of brought me up short and kind of showed me, like, you know what, you got a long way to go before you can get your focus where it needs to be. And for myself, Al-Anon was an invitation to, get focused on myself. And my story is going to cross just a little bit in the beginning, at least, because that's just the way it is. What I've got to share is my own experience, strength, and hope, and if I don't share me, we got nothing going on, so that's what you get. And for me, intimacy is about me being me and me allowing you to see me. I pretty much shoot from the hip, so one thing I'll just share, I know that Guy read the 12 traditions, something that has served me a lot in my recovery. Anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions. Every mind has placed principles above personalities. And that's super important that I don't talk to people about other people I see in the rooms and break their anonymity. And I thought that's all it meant. But the fact of the matter is, for me, even more important is to listen to the message and not like just scratch you off because you're the messenger and I think you're this or I think you're that or you're a jerk or whatever, is so that I can like grow and hear and be a channel from whatever you've got to offer, and not like put you in some category and just shut myself off, because I used to do that in my early recovery. So you may like me, you may hate me, you may think I'm crazy, whatever. It's totally fine. I'm not going to try to please you all. I can promise you that. I learned that in Al-Anon too, right? If I'm going to try to please you all, I got a real codependent problem happening. I came into Al-Anon in 1986 and was going to at least, I can't even count. I was just immersed in meetings. And I became a service junkie, actually. I'm just going to share because it's part of my story. I helped build the Narcotics Anonymous Fellowship in the greater New York region. And I was doing way more than, I didn't understand my motivation for some of it until I crashed and burned at about 3.5 years in my recovery process. Crashed and burned really hard. And I'm grateful that you mentioned, we talked a little bit about ACOA stuff, because my story is definitely that of an ACA. And where I was, 3.5 years, I was laying in bed for 16 hours a day for 3 months straight. And a friend of mine said, you gotta go. And I will say this, if it wasn't for 12-step fellowships, I wouldn't be here today. If it was only for 12-step fellowships, I wouldn't be here either. I know that for sure. And 12-step fellowships have taught me to trust myself. They've taught me to identify what I'm feeling, which to me, you know, these steps are a pathway to myself. And that pathway has really been, a path to introduce me to myself and to introduce me to my feelings. For me, and I've got some notes here on each step, and I wasn't even sure I was going to make any notes because I've spoken before and I don't normally make notes, but I felt like I would make a few notes for this just because, you know, it's an hour and it's kind of a short. I didn't finish that little story, but after a few more days when I was joking with Chris, he called me back and said, hey, we were joking about you being the keynote speaker and Kimberly's dad just died. So are you willing and able to, you know, fill in? So that was about 5 days ago, I think, maybe 6 days ago. So grateful that I was able to be here and that I'm able to share my experience with you guys. And maybe we can keep Kimberly and her family in our thoughts. I mean, that's obviously no fun. But back to the ACA stuff, I mean, I was led to do a bunch of childhood trauma work. And for the first 3.5 years of my recovery, I had no idea that I came from an alcoholic family. In spite of growing up with my father pouring alcohol down people's, you know, throats, essentially, he was a very functional alcoholic. My mother was a very, very sick, untreated Al-Anon who did not want to be rescued. And I'll just... I'm going to talk a fair amount about that experience because that was my experience, and my real liberation came from processing a lot of that trauma and continues to this day. I'll just share on this note, I read the daily readers, we have 3 daily readers in Al-Anon. I read them every day, and one of them that really stands out for me is on the first step. It talks about, you know, I used to do a lot of thinking about the first step. Now, I do a lot of feeling about the first step. And that feeling can best be described in one word, grief. And on the outside, my family looked like the perfect family. My father was an executive at one of the biggest corporations in the world, and he worked in their headquarters, and my siblings were all honor students, and I didn't understand a lot about the roles that different people play, and this was, you know, back in the 70s when I was in high school, late 70s. But, you know, I was led to believe through obviously positive intentions in the rooms that, you know, all my parents did the best they could do with what they had to work with, so I forgave them. Well, I did that and I played along with that and didn't know it wasn't working until I got liberated in a whole nother level. I had to get permission to get angry first. I had to be shown that there was a lot wrong with the system. And while it's talked about generations, I have a good friend in New York who likes to say, you know, the fact of the matter is families have been abusing each other for centuries. This didn't just start 2 generations ago, and I'm trying to heal it in one lifetime, which is pretty damn formidable, right? So I need to be super gentle with myself. I need to be really, really gentle and realize that I see only a little way. And you know, I think I know what's right for you, and the stronger my convictions, the more lost I am. And frequently, the stronger my convictions, the more fear I'm in. Because I want to find some false sense of security to hang on to. You know, I want to put everything in its own category so I can feel some false sense of control in my life, which is a lot of BS, right? I mean, and I didn't know a lot of stuff. One of my teachers likes to say, I may as well start with I don't know, because that's where you're going to wind up anyway. I love that line, and one of the reasons I love it is because it's so true. In another one of the daily readers, it says, all of my beliefs came about from a frame of reference, which is certain to change. Like 2 weeks from now, I'm probably going to have a very different opinion about certain things than I have today. Yet I will debate with you to the death over what I believe in this moment. You know, I will like, you're wrong, and here's why, and blah, 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 right? That used to be much more so decades ago. But having the humility to be teachable, to recognize that I can see only a little way, has been an enormous gift when I can align myself with that. So let me see here. I'll say this. This is really funny. When I first came into Al-Anon, for me, it's funny anyway. I mean, it was mostly women. You know, this is like mid-80s, and it was mostly women. There was maybe one man for every 15 women, you know. And some of the people I knew in AA used to call those groups the Sweet Sisters of Revenge. I thought that was so funny. Obviously, I remembered it, you know, it just stuck a chord. I was like, and then, you know, obviously, I've gone through a pretty significant personal process in my own life, you know, with my gender stuff, and had nothing but shame and guilt, and didn't understand. I'm just going to talk about it briefly, and but didn't understand why I was in my mother's clothes, and then I came into recovery. Is this an addiction? Am I, you know, some sex addict, or what the hell's going on? And I remember going into the Lunch Bunch down in Salt Lake on a Wednesday. I used to go to that meeting for probably 16 years, an Al-Anon meeting. And I walked in as Charisse. It was about 7 years ago. And, you know, you could cut the air with a knife, right? It's like, what the hell is going on? So, you know, the meeting got open, and I said, well, I may as well get this over with. And I said to the group, I said, and I didn't know what I was going to say. It's just God just coming through me. But it flowed, and it was just something I smile about. But I was saying, you know, when I first came into Al-Anon, it was all a bunch of women, and then over the years, I've seen a lot more men come into the room, so I figured I had to shift the balance back a little bit. So, you know, I try to find some humor in my recovery, and I believe me, like I mentioned the word grief, I've had lots of grief and lots of sadness, and I've shared, and I believe, I know for sure for myself from very explicit examples, and I'll share one or two or maybe three, whatever, of those with you, that my life will be as good as I can grieve. And nobody told me that. It's just something that I've come to realize and to see. And I guess what I'll share with you is, you know, some of that stuff that happened, you know, when I was younger. And I'll do it by way of examples. There was a time when I was doing some outside work with somebody who was way ahead of her time. I'm talking about a therapist, and it talks about that in the literature. Wilson was in therapy for 16 years, needed it critically at 4 years. When I first came into recovery, the Alzheimer's would shame you into shutting up and call it psychobabble if you talked about, you know, therapy or any of that stuff. Well, whatever. I mean, we've obviously evolved from then. And our focus is on the 12 steps. But I don't dance on eggshells in any room. I share what's going on for me, and that either works or not. If it doesn't for you, you know, you're gonna have to talk to your sponsor or your higher power or whatever with it. But so it was suggested that I terminate communication with my family. Now, I grew up in the Hudson Valley, and I got clean, and my earlier years of recovery were in the Albany area, which is, you know, another hour and a half north. I wasn't in any communication with my family. It was like there was no communication, hardly at all. You know, maybe once or twice a month I'd be talking to my parents. My siblings, three siblings, were spread around the country, and so I couldn't do it. And I watched these people in this group that I was working with, you know, growing like weeds after they terminated communication with their family. Like, how are they having any kind of impact on me? You know, and I did some work with this woman very reluctantly, and it was a lot of blind faith on a couple of friends that I really had a lot of belief in. And I was part of an ACOA group, which is, people probably know there's an ACA fellowship, and there's also an ACOA part of Al-Anon. And in different parts of the country, I've been to different meetings, and different meetings seem to have different strengths in different places. And, you know, this was an unbelievable group of very gentle, loving people that I was blessed to be involved with. And in spite of the fact that I crashed and burned 3.5 years in these rooms, I can now see it was an amazing gift and blessing, you know, what happened and who I was led to. But anyway, so I ultimately, a few months into this process, terminated all communication with my family. 4.5 months later, and it was supposed to be a 6-month window. And 4.5 months later, my oldest brother called me and said, Dad's got a brain tumor. He's not going to make it. We've had him to the best doctors in New York and Boston and West Point, and he's not making it. So I'm calling you to let you know. Well, I decided that was big enough for me. He was 63 when we learned that. And so I decided that was big enough to just reconnect with the family. And very shortly thereafter, my oldest brother, and I'd been trying to get my mother into Al-Anon for years. I was about 6.5 years sober at the time and 6 years in Al-Anon. And very shortly after I reconnected with the family, my oldest brother said to me that the very week you stopped communicating with the family, Mom started going to Al-Anon. The very week. That was a huge validation that this therapist that I was working with knew what the hell she was talking about. And I had more and more of those validations over the course of time. She was an enlightened witness in my process, in my life, and somebody I'm still in touch with periodically. She's down in Florida, retired now with her husband, but she had done her own work, and she was capable of saying, you know what, that's my stuff. Like 3 times in 3.5 years, she said that to me, like, whoa, like, thanks for being human. You know, it wasn't like behind some desk protecting herself, like, you know, whatever. But, anyway, that was a huge deal. My father ultimately passed, and that was a really big deal. There was like 150 people at his funeral, and they recorded it, and I still haven't listened to that recording, but he died in August, early August, and 10 days later, I graduated from a community college. Let me just let you know, I came into these rooms with a high school equivalency diploma, homeless, sleeping under a bridge in LA. For 10 years of my life, between 14 and 24, I was in and out of jails and hospitals and Grateful Dead concerts. That was my life. And here's something that's really funny now, but it was the absolute worst thing that could have possibly happened in my entire life, and I couldn't think of anything worse happening. And frankly, I still think it's probably one of the worst things that could ever happen to somebody, but I'm obviously a huge deadhead. And Jerry Garcia Band played in my hometown at this old bar, used to be a vaudeville, you know, whatever, theater, and all the big band, U2 played there before they played anywhere else in the country. It was like a test place before they played in New York, but anyway, it was just a really special place, and I was in jail a mile away. 6 months earlier, I was 3,000 miles away in California to see him, and I couldn't go to the show, and I'm literally less than a mile from this fucking bar, excuse my language. Can tell how much I appreciate, you know. I was like, it's over. Life is over. It was literally one of the worst nights of my life. And oh my God. Like I said, all I got to share is me, so, I mean, you get what you get. Al-Anon has taught me that, you know, I need to resist the temptation to take the world personally. You know, I look for places to find offense and take offense. I'm going to jump around a little bit, but it is a temptation of mine. I abandon myself all day, and I want to blame you for how I feel. I want to, like, make it all your fault. You know, the word qualifier, which is frequently used in Al-Anon, and the word codependent is also frequently used in Al-Anon, well, they're not in any Al-Anon literature anywhere. But again, I don't dance on eggshells. I just qualify that because everybody likes to say, well, my qualifier this or my qualifier that. Today, I know that I am my own qualifier. I know that I am the one who abandons me. I'm the only one who can betray me. I'm the only one who can be in my own corner, regardless of what you or anyone else in my life does. I deserve my own love and forgiveness. I have an obligation. I feel an obligation to myself. You know, part of my amends to myself and the universe, part of my amends to my family is to have a successful life and try to be, you know, at peace and be a channel and be compassionate and loving to others rather than this angry, raging teenager that they needed me to be. And I'll talk a little bit about that right now. So I learned, first, like I mentioned a few minutes ago, I didn't even know I came from an alcoholic family until I was in recovery for a few years and had somebody break down my denial. I was like, if you ask me about my family in the first few years, are you kidding? My dad's an executive at IBM. My mother has all these friends. My siblings are honor students. I am the fuck up. And don't you ever forget it. I would get in your face over it. That's how intense my denial needed to be to protect myself from the trauma that was underneath, if it was anything different than that. You know, I learned that I developed the roles that I played in order to avoid feeling the trauma that was underneath if I hadn't played the role in the first place. And so ultimately, you know, I would be going to my mother and saying, this isn't what I meant. I didn't, you know, and I can remember it like it was yesterday. Like I could be this high looking up and her, this isn't what I meant, blah, 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 blah. I'll give a good example. About 4 months after my dad passed, I was coming home from my first semester at school in Boston, and my mother liked us to go to church if we were in town. So I went, my mother's on my right, my younger brother's on my left, I'm in the center, and they're passing around the plate, and I never went to church. But 2 years earlier, they gave me a $700 scholarship because my father told them to, essentially. And whatever. And I pulled out a $20 bill because I just got a grant and I wanted to give something back. And I had, you know, earned a full scholarship, $26,400 a year, and that was, you know, 1992. So I felt really grateful in that I, and it was because I did really well at the community college, whatever. So I pulled out this $20 bill and my mother puts her hand on my arm and says, you don't have to do that. Dad's given enough money to the church. And I wanted to just beat her with a bat, you know. I'm like, what are you talking? Just get, you know. I'm like 30 years old. Give me a fucking break, right? A minute later, my younger brother leans over and says, why do you got to yell at mom in church? So on my way, I had made an appointment. Exactly. I mean, so I'm feeling like really conflicted, did not understand what was going on. But I had made an appointment with this therapist on my way back through to Boston a couple days later. I had made an appointment in Albany with this person I'd done all that work with. And I said, Ann, da 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 da. She said, that was your mother punching you in your nose, handing you her rage, and she's been doing it your entire life. There's no way I was going to learn that by working these steps or with any sponsor. And it fit. And she knew me exceptionally well. And there's other things that happened that I just brushed off. And I said, oh, I just drank because I was a real alcoholic. Well, I never, ever, ever, never, ever, even before I did this work with outside, you know, found myself in chapter 3. I mean, I don't know what it's like to be a real alcoholic. I tried to force myself into all these sentences. Today, I can trust myself enough to know where I fit and where I don't. And for some people, that might be exactly what they are, real alcoholics. It just isn't my story. It's not what I can identify with. And thank God I've learned to trust myself, because for me, the real liberation comes from identifying my feelings, learning how to feel those feelings, being willing and able to shake in my boots, feel my fears, as opposed to acting out to try to avoid feeling them, right? And then therein lies my truth. But you know, when I was 11 years old, I'm just going to inject a couple of these stories, like I mentioned. When I was 11 years old, I had an older brother that I idolized. I mean, they walked on water. And I was going to follow them around on their paper route. And I was riding down the hill. Our house kind of sat near the top of the hill. And I was going down the hill with no hands, like an 11-year-old does, right? And there's only this big rock in the road. There's a huge road, but I have to go right at this rock for some reason. And I went right over the handlebars, and one of my teeth came out, and I broke my jaw. It was a Friday afternoon. It was like 4:30, and they're like, my mother was, you know, freaking out. It's like the neighbors had to calm her down as much as they had to try to figure out how they're going to get me to some orthopedist or doc, you know, not or but whatever, orthopedic doctor or whatever for my teeth, dentist. Anyway, so they found this dentist who wired my jaw together, and I'm in this chair for like over an hour. And my oldest brother, not the one I was following, but my oldest brother and my mother were with me in this room, and I'm in shock and couldn't talk, and my face is all bloody, and I was just laying there, and I couldn't speak. And then I saw my father's face between my oldest brother and my mother. And I started squirming in the chair, trying to get away from him because I was afraid he was going to beat me. And I started apologizing for getting hurt because it was going to cost money. That shit affects people. It affected me. And yet I came into the rooms and drank the Kool-Aid and shamed the shit out of myself as if none of that shit mattered. It matters a lot, and I don't think people drink themselves to death over nothing. I don't buy, for me, it doesn't fit that I just drink because I was programmed to drink. It just doesn't fit for me. You know, I opened a Grapevine. It was probably 1988. I remember very vividly. And inside there was a picture of a mountain range, and it said, "There are many paths to the summit, and they all lead to the same place." Part of my problems in my recovery and in my life was needing you to follow the same path that I followed and trying to force other people to see it my way, because I didn't have enough courage and trust inside to be able to just be okay with my own path regardless of what other people's paths were. you know, I'll come back to some of the things that I've learned in Al-Anon. Al-Anon only works just for today, right? Like AA is, you know, one day at a time. I mean, I need to be willing to be here now, to be in today, you know, October 4th. If I go into next week, I'm going to be in fear. You know, it's that simple. No matter what's going on. I don't just, and Chuck Chamberlain's famous for this, but, you know, I just don't, you know, believe in miracles. I depend on them. I mean, and, you know, it's been really a true thing in my recovery that, you know, I just depend on miracles. I used to think I could know what you needed, and I know what's going on for you. And the truth is, I cannot know anything for another. I cannot know anything for another. As much as I think I know you, I really don't at all. Even my best friends. I know everybody comes from their own ingredients. I know I grew up under the same roof as three siblings, and I also know we all grew up in completely different universes. There's no question about that for me today. I have a sponsee that was down in Central America a few years ago, and wound up at this seminar, and they were there for the summer, but they just wound up going to this seminar. And the person leading the seminar, this is like one of the most loving things I've ever heard in my entire life, and I really like it. The person leading the seminar said to the group, "If I were you, I would be who you are. I would have said everything you ever said, I would have done everything you ever did, and I would be exactly who you are. I mean, not if I were you, I would do this, this, and this. Not if I were you, I would have done that, that, and that. I have no idea what I would have done. The ingredients that make me up are very different, I'm quite certain, than everybody else in this room. And I would be willing to bet that that's true for everybody in this room." I mean, that's just my perspective today. And I need to work really hard sometimes to recognize that if I was that person, and it helps me in my life to not carry around the weight of other people's stuff. I mean, it's like I see someone cutting me off or feeling like I'm being cut off, and I'm taking the offense, right? They're not giving it. They're not offering it. I'm never going to see them again. But if I'm taking that offense, you know, it's on me, right? I mean, Al-Anon has been very liberating in many, many ways. You know, it's been an invitation for me to, you know, to meet myself where I am. You know, it's about self-care. You know, some of my friends, I have some amazing friends, and hopefully all of us do, but, you know, one of my friends likes to say, embryonic steps are quantum leaps when measured objectively. If I could really have seen everything that was going on inside of me when I came into these rooms, first of all, I would never would have stayed probably, but which is why that denial comes in handy, right? It's like, damn, thank God for denial, you know? And it was funny because I remember just last week I was at a meeting and I was like, I'm always in denial. I am always in denial. Next week or next month, I'm going to see something that I've been in denial about right now. And part of the reason I say that is I've traveled light years myself personally, thanks to you and plenty of people like you and, you know, amazing, amazing enlightened witnesses that have, you know, been channels for me. My first sponsor just celebrated 41 years, and I'm going to jump around just a little bit because I want to cover some things here, but, I'm going to talk about the steps and some of the things that I got from specific steps. I mean, I've been through the steps 10 times diligently, and I've also taken people through the steps. And I've had some sponsees put bullets in their head up on the hill, and I've had other sponsees that have, you know, that have 12 step that have, you know, they recently just celebrated 33 years, you know, and they think, you know, and I'm not responsible for either of those. You know, all I was doing was just trying to share what was given to me. And, you know, I can't control anything else. And whatever centuries of abuse that one sponsee's family instilled in that person that took their own life up the hill, you know, is not something I could control. Can't cure it, and I didn't cause it. Anyway, so I guess I want to share another little story, not a little story, but a significant thing that happened recently. Well, two stories. One is about 8 years ago, the sibling that I thought walked on water, this person was the biggest drug dealer in high school and also president of the National Honor Society at the same time. I couldn't do both. And I didn't know this, but I knew they were smoking cocaine for a while in college. And, you know, and this person could sell ice to the Eskimos, extremely intelligent, you know, good looking, you know, just everybody loved this, loved him. And about 8 years ago, I got a phone call from my oldest brother saying, Mark's in the hospital, he's got three holes in his lungs, and he's in intensive care, and Mom and I are flying out, you know, tomorrow morning, just to let you know. So he was coming from Florida, my mother was coming from New York. They go out there, and so I'm immediately, you know, I'm decades in recovery, right? And so I'm immediately talking to, you know, some of you may know Russ here, and he connected me to what I believe is one of the better intervention specialists in the country. She was out of Chicago, and so I'm talking to, I've got a group of us, and we're all having this conference calls with his college buddies, his high school friends. I knew all of these guys. And then my other siblings and my mother. And so we're going to try to figure out how we're going to do this intervention. Like, what are we going to do? He's going to figure it out, you know. We'll fly him to you know, wherever, and tell him there's a concert, and we'll all jump him in a hotel room or something, right? I mean, we were really struggling because we knew he was going to figure something out. And so his best friend from college called me and said, listen, we got to narrow this circle because I'm worried Tom or Kevin are going to tell your brother. And I'm like, well, screw that. That's not happening. So his best buddy from college, two high school friends, and my siblings and my mother were on these conference calls then. And we had, you know, every other day we're trying to orchestrate this. People from all over the country trying to figure out how we're going to make this happen. Well, I'll give you one guess. He tells my brother that we're trying to plan this intervention. My mother. She's, like I said, a very sick, untreated Al-Anon who needed us in crisis or dead. I was the scapegoat in my family. I was the pressure relief valve. I was talking about how telling my mother, you know, this isn't how I felt, this isn't what I meant, blah, 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 as a little kid, and she was like orchestrating. She didn't have any skills, no tools to take care of herself at all. And so ultimately when she, my dad, I'm going to come back to the intervention in a moment, but I just want to insert this piece. When I couldn't handle watching my mother being abused by my father. So, you know, I would start a problem over here on the other side of the room, and it diverted my father's attention and rage. And so ultimately my mother would literally started when I was a little kid, because she had no skills to take care of herself, started setting me up to be beaten by my father and used me as a shield to protect herself. And my siblings lined up right behind her. That was my youth. To me, it was evil. I've been abused as in every way you can be abused. I was beaten out of my body. Teachers, neighbors, doctors, judges, lawyers, everybody, what's wrong with that angry kid? Back in the 70s, they weren't doing a lot of, you know, family dynamic stuff. It was really early in that, you know. It was always about drugging up the kids. You know, that was the easiest solution. hence me being in and out of jails and hospitals, you know. And I just, everybody. And I actually, when I moved here, I tried to rebuild my support system, because moving 2000, I moved here 25 years ago from Boston after I finished school. Excuse me, yeah, 24 years ago. But I'll tell you a funny thing. In the middle of all this heavy shit, you know, I'm like, Pete, if I go to school, I was 28. If I go to school now, I'm going to be 32 when I graduate. And he looked at me and he said, you're going to be 32 whether you go to school or not. So I thought that was pretty funny. And it was like the thing that pushed me over the edge. All right, I'll go, you know, I'll just surrender. And I worked full-time. I went to school full-time for the first 2 years. And the second 2 years, I didn't. I just was in school full-time. But anyway, so back to this, you know, dynamic in my family. I mean, my mother, and I'm going to come back to the intervention in a second, but I just want to finish this dynamic out through to where we're at now. 3.5 years ago, my best friend's wife called me. It was a Monday morning, and said, "Your mother died Friday." And I didn't even know she was sick, and I didn't know she died. She didn't, you know, she said, "How are you? Are you okay?" You know, and I knew something was up for Lily to call me on Monday morning. I'm like, something's happening. Because she, you know, grew up in the same town. My best friend and his wife, we were like high school, we were in grade school. Like, him and I were like playpen together. I mean, we were like this. We got wrecked together. We got arrested together. Went to, you know, jail together. You know, he wound up getting clean for a year. Then I came in. Then he went back out. And then he came back in. And he's been clean ever since. But it was just, anyway, very tight is the main point of that. And she called me and just said, and when that happened, when I got that phone call, it was like, it was bittersweet, because most of my life, including my recovery, I was of the opinion, well, you know, it's my family, you know, they're always there for me. No, Cherise, no. It's always been a dry well. And I've been in denial because it was too painful to believe that I was used as this tool. So the family system, you guys have probably seen the, you know, maybe if you haven't, I'll try and describe it. You know, the kids' mobiles, you know, like on hangers and strings and different things, and they're all balanced. And if one of them shifts, the whole thing collapses. Well, that's what happened when I terminated communication with my family. I shifted. I stepped out of it, and my mother collapsed and started going to a few Al-Anon meetings. By the way, she didn't continue. She said, "Oh, those people are way sicker than I am." Yeah, right, Mom. So, you know, whatever. I can't, you know, force anyone to do anything, but... anyway, one of the most important things for me today, no matter what I'm doing, is not to get angry. And I struggle with that sometimes. I'll be honest, I walk into an Al-Anon meeting and I'm walking into a room filled with my mother in many ways. And I don't say that in a negative way, but I am really tested. Because frankly, one of my beliefs is, and I'm going to come back to that intervention in just a second, but one of my... beliefs is, you know, and this came from one of my teachers, and they didn't say it exactly like this, but one of my teachers says, hope exists next week or next month. It's not present right now. You know, everything's hopeless. And not in a negative way, but in the context of, I need to be right here, right now. And if I believe next week or next month's going to be better, I can avoid feeling the trauma that I'm in right now. You know, and hence, you know, I'm of the belief that we're sharing our experience, strength, and denial in these rooms. And I needed it. And I needed it. You know, I personally believe I've been through an evolution of consciousness. You know, I know a lot more now, much more awake than I've ever been in my life. You know, I wish, you know, I didn't need to do all this extra work, but I'm a fighter, you know, I'm persistent as it can be. And that's something I'd offer out as, you know, I've always had this, in spite of the dysfunctional dynamic that I came from, I've had this, one of the gifts from that role that I had was, I'm going to prove them wrong someday, some way. I'm going to transcend all this stuff. And it's one of the things that has driven me not to hang myself or to kill myself, you know, with some of the dark depressions that I've been through. And so back to this intervention. So, you know, I wanted to get on a plane and beat my mother with a bat, right? I mean, here she is needing my brother, dad, or in a crisis, and I'm trying to save his life. Like, are you kidding me? Are you kidding me? And I didn't handle it as well as I would have liked. You know, I did get into it with my oldest brother, because he was starting to defend her. One of the things he said to me, he said, we were on a phone call, just him and I, and he goes, "You can't say that to Mom." I don't even remember specifically what it was, because if you say that, she will feel blank. And I exploded. I just screamed at the top of my lungs, and I remember it, and I feel some shame about it and some guilt. You know, like, you know, I just screamed, you know, F you, as loud as I could. I could barely talk afterward. It was so passionate. It was like, I am done dancing on eggshells for this woman, which I did my entire life. You know, I was whipped with belt buckles to play the piano. I mean, I was going to fit into this model that this family was, you know, and... that wasn't something I wanted to do. It wasn't who I was, you know. And I'll also share. So anyway, that blew up and I created more wreckage, right? That's my side of the street. When I get angry, that's something that therapist said. When you get angry, they can point the finger at you. And that's what they want. They want to be able to say, you're the problem. And so I was constantly being set up to be angry and irritated. And it is accepting responsibility to acknowledge that truth. I'd much rather deny it. It's easier to deny it because then I don't have to feel the reality of the betrayal and the abandonment and, you know, what's really true. You know, I'd be much prefer to say, oh, I was the problem. But the fact is I was a symptom of the problem. And so when my, let me see here. Coming back to, let me talk a little bit about the steps, I guess, specifically, because I know it was something that was specifically requested. So I'll just talk really briefly. You know, I mentioned Al-Anon has been an invitation to meet myself where I am, you know, and I talked about step one and my powerlessness and recognizing that I used to do a lot of, I could really identify with that you know, reading in one of the Daily Readers about, used to do a lot of thinking about the powerlessness and then started to become aware of, you know, doing a lot of feeling about powerlessness. And that feeling best be described as grief. You know, for me, that's, you know, I'm powerless, but I'm not helpless. You know, I've got a lot of capacity. I'm relatively intelligent. Most people that I know in the rooms are. And, you know, miracles, I've watched them. I came here on blind faith, the second step. I listened to enough of you guys talking about how this is where you came from and then how you transcended it and how things are totally different. And I couldn't even comprehend that you could possibly have gone through that looking at your life today. And I'm like, are you serious? You know? So that was, you know, a blind faith. My second step was a lot of blind faith, just like, phew. One thing I'll say, you know, I did get a sponsor. I mentioned this person earlier, and I know for sure, back in New York, it wasn't, at least back in the 80s, people didn't raise their hand if you work the 12 steps and you are willing and able to sponsor people. To me, okay, again, this is my story, my perspective. That's called codependence. You know, that's promotion to me. If I didn't have to cross the river of fear that I had to cross to ask that person to sponsor me, I don't know if I ever would have had a sponsor. And if someone comes to me and offers me something without me even asking, it's like they're doing something for me that I need to somehow learn to do for myself. This is, again, just my perspective. I know for sure that it was paramount to my getting a foundation for me. I was petrified to ask this person to sponsor me because this person walked out in water. I mean, is just an amazing human being, you know, former New York firefighter, actually captain, and it's carried people out of buildings, you know, burning buildings, and you know, and their story was really heavy duty. I mean, they decapitated somebody driving, you know, that was what brought them into the rooms. Big time, you know, and I'm not sure, I don't do their inventory, but I know that they have been nothing but committed to trying to carry a message and be a channel, you know, and is an amazing channel and has been for, you know, a long time. You know, I talked about some of these things and traumatic experience that I've come from, and, you know, I think I mentioned I dropped out of high school after 10th grade. Teachers would say, like, what's wrong with you? Your siblings are honor students, blah, 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 that whole thing. You know, I felt insane. I thought I was crazy. I needed to believe I was crazy in order to protect my mother and my siblings. That's the dynamic. You know, I will suffer. I will be this problem for you. And there's been times in my life when I will beg you to be your problem. You know, I will get angry because something's triggered and I want to make sure that whatever it is, I'm not going to feel it. So I'll stay angry. And really what's going on is I'm trying to protect my mother from my dad's rage with my dysfunctional survival tools. So I developed blind faith in my sponsors, and you know, I did a lot of meetings. I was told that the solution is in the steps. You know, I come to meetings to feel better, but I work the steps to get better, and there is a major difference, as I'm sure most of you would agree. You know, my third step. You know, today I have a God of my misunderstanding. You know, I don't have any idea. I do believe, you know, faith moves mountains. But don't forget to bring your shovel. You know, that's a line that I heard early on, and I'm really grateful that I heard it early on. And, you know, I had to show up. I had to do an awful lot of work, a lot more than I thought I was going to need to do, frankly. I didn't really even know what I was going to need to do, but I just knew I was in a world of hurt and, you know, that gift of desperation, you know. My fourth step, once I put a pen to paper, I just wrote pages, you know. And thank God for my first sponsor, you know, because I was taught that it's about identifying my patterns. It's not about a witch hunt. It's about just seeing my patterns. And the fifth step, and this is sort of a conglomerate of you know, my experiences working through the steps in different capacities and different ways, is as many different ways of working the steps as there are people, right? And I believe, like I said, all of, there are many paths to the summit, and they all lead to the same place. You know, good on you if it's serving you, you know, and it's, who am I to judge if it's right or wrong? You know, there's plenty of people. I know there's people in California now that are like going through the big book, line, sentence by sentence. Oh my God, I can't even comprehend. Are you kidding me? Are you kidding me? I have to identify with every syllable in this sentence and then we'll move on to the next one tomorrow? Are you kidding me? To me, that's a little bit obsessive, a little bit too much for me. I forget what those groups are called, but I mean, whatever. And if it works for them, you know, if it's, they're staying sober and it's, you know, doing something for them, good for them. It's just, I know, not for me, which is, you know. But I don't think I've ever met anybody that's done a fearless moral inventory. I mean, is that even possible? I mean, it's like more of the unrealistic expectations I came from. You know, Wilson said over and over, more and more will be revealed. We realize we know only a little. More will constantly be disclosed to you and to us, right? And I firmly believe that I'm standing on Bill Wilson's shoulders. And one thing I will say this with regards to my mother, her and I obviously had a very difficult relationship. I remember one time saying to her, you know, what the hell do you want, my blood? Literally, you know, so by the way, with regards to her passing, you know, I didn't even know if I was going to go to the funeral, but one of my teachers that I described said, no, she brought you into this world with love, you know, you're going to see her out in love. And so I decided, okay, I'll fly to New York. I went to the funeral, my siblings didn't even speak to me. It was the first time I flew to anywhere as Charisse. You know, this is somewhat relatively new, 5-6 years. I just changed my name legally in 16. She passed on April 15th, tax day, coincidentally. She was a big tax on me, but so, you know, my neighbors, my aunts and uncles, what's wrong with your siblings? I'm like, I can't speak for them. I don't know. You know, I don't know. And it was really sad to see. In fact, one of my nephews and my youngest brother tried to prevent me from going to, like, the reception at the other part of the church after the funeral. And I'm like, I didn't even acknowledge them because I didn't know what to say. And it just hurt. And I was available to the sadness that it was. You know, I'd done enough grief work to and that's why it was bittersweet when Lily called me that morning and said, your mom died. It's because I'd done a lot of work. I'd done a lot of grief work. I'd done a lot of processing trauma. And it was really, it was like a drink of water. It was a validation. As sad as it was a validation that, you know, this is just the truth. Your family's really dysfunctional. And everybody was doing the best they could do with what they had to work with. Yes. But my parents would have gone to prison, you know, if had they been caught with what, you know, happened. And I will say this also. All three of my siblings right now, if they were in these chairs, they would say that I was beaten more than all three of them combined, and they would also say that I did more work around the house than all three of them combined. My dad used to, you know, he had like 10 or 15,000 employees. He spent $7 million a week for IBM and back in the, you know, 70s buying parts. He was procurement manager, whatever. And he used to, and I would proudly hear him tell me, you're my hardest worker, you know. And I'm like, now I can see how, you know, desperate I was for his approval, because nothing was ever good enough. The problem with that is, and you're not worth the powder to blow you to hell while he's beating me out of my body. That was the most common thing he's ever said. And I'll say another thing about my oldest sibling. He had a severe stuttering problem in his early adolescence. And still to this day, whenever he interacts with the family, stutters pretty significantly. And all my siblings are relatively successful in the business world, if you will. If that's how one measure of success or whatever. But one thing he, you know, the most loving thing that ever happened in my family, and I've told him this, is, and I'll share something else. It was an amends to my mother that I made right after. But one of the things he said to me about 20 years ago, I remember being in my living room and I was talking to him and I was ranting and I was rambling about all this crap. And he watched me go from homeless under a bridge in LA to graduating from Boston University with a full scholarship, sitting for the CPA exam, you know. And he knew something happened. He knew something happened. And he would just listen to me. And he said to me on this call, he said, listen, you need to know that I get it. I know that you know. But you need to know that I don't know. In other words, he was saying, I hear you. I know you know something. I know you've learned something. I know, but I do not grasp what you're talking about. But he was willing to listen to me. That's the most loving thing I've ever received from my family. And with my mother, the comment I just referenced, you know, one of the times when we did connect, before I came out to her, that was about, you know, 7 years ago, you know, she said, how do you, I told her, Mom, you were forced into the marriage, and she's like, how do you know so much? How can you possibly know so much? And I said, Mom, she goes, how can you see all this stuff? And I said, Mom, I can see farther than you because I'm standing on your shoulders. And I was starting to make amends in those ways to my siblings and my mother, because I knew for sure once this became my truth, once I embraced what was true for me, that there was no more family. And that proved to be true. When I told my mother about this whole gender thing, that I've been in therapy for years and I've been you know, working with, you know, medical professionals and blah, 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 you know, and I got to tell you something, and I'm crying my eyes out. And she's like, 30 minutes later, we're both crying on the phone, but I said, remember when you were, do you remember dinner saying, asking who the hell's been in your clothes? And I said, well, that was me, and that was part of my making amends, and I apologize. Because I knew it might be one of the last times I ever speak to her. And I felt like I wanted to own that, because I knew she was lost in that family and she had no bearing. And she would ask periodically, who's been in my clothes? And 30 minutes later, she sent me an email saying, I can't handle this. Don't contact me again. Signed, the one who gave birth to you. Dash, maybe I shouldn't have. It's the woman I grew up and gave my blood for, almost died for many times, was homeless essentially for. So thank God to Al-Anon, you know, I've been able to detach from a lot of the sickness that is my family system and know that it's not about me today. And I'm going to jump back to these steps and start wrapping up here. But, you know, so for me, the fifth step, you know, admitted to God, to myself, another human being, exact nature of my wrongs. The exact nature of my wrongs are my emotions. They're my feelings, my fears, my insecurities, my jealousies, my anger. That's why I did what I did, so I wouldn't feel. You know, I need to learn how to shake in my boots. And how do I do that? I connect with a higher power. I connect with other people on a spiritual path. You know, the sixth step, I was talking to a different sponsor, my second Al-Anon sponsor. We were walking along the river one time, and I was talking about all this crisis I was dealing with, and I was struggling with this and struggling with that, and I'm like, wow. And they said to me, and I was like, oh, you know, I was like banging my head on the wall. I goes, oh, you're working the sixth step. Like, that's what the sixth step is banging your head on the wall. It's like becoming ready, you know. And I'm like, wow, I never knew it was that simple. You know, I thought it had to be a lot more complicated than that, right? I got to sit and figure this shit out somehow, right? Well, one thing I've also learned in recovery is my heart makes quantum leaps and my mind goes around in circles. And I was all neck up for the first number of years in recovery until I crashed and burned and then realized that, you know, Wilson talked about, you know, one of the most important things for alcoholics is, you know, not to try to cover up a bad motive with a good motive. You know, and I'll never forget my good friend Stuart, you know, called me, you know, when I was in that depression of 3 months in bed for 16 hours a day. And he's like, because people were like, couldn't, you know, I mean, this was after, by the way, I don't know if I mentioned it, but it was after the longest relationship I've ever had with this woman who was an amazing woman. And nobody believed us when we broke up. I mean, we were the recovering couple. I mean, it was like, we were it. My friends were like, where did you meet her? She's so smart. She's so beautiful, blah, blah, blah. And I'm just like, anyway, they thought it was like Paul is dead kind of thing, you know, like this big hoax, but, you know, it just happened. And so no one expected it, least of all us in particular, but she had her own abuse issues. One thing I've learned is water seeks its own level. You know, and if I'm this nuts over here, whoever I'm bonding with is this nuts over here, and there's no other way it could ever, we could ever connect. One of my friends like to say, yeah, when the holes in my head fit the, you know, points in their head, you know, we got this great relationship going on. But anyway. let's see here. Seven step, you know, for me, humility is an invitation to let go of the drama. You know, humility is about me being me and me allowing you to see me, having my feet on the ground, recognizing that, you know what, I do have a lot of great qualities. I do have a lot of love in my heart. And I do have a lot of capacity for, you know, compassion and patience, in addition to sometimes being consumed with myself and angry and jealous and irritable and all of these things. And I talked about, you know, survival tools. I don't believe I'm defective. I don't buy it for a second. I think there's a lot of shame-based BS, frankly, in the original 12-step literature, and it really something I drank in thinking I was the problem. It just fit perfectly. But then I had to realize, you know what, maybe some of it doesn't fit, and maybe some of it's not healthy for me. You know, I will say this, I was listening to Dr. Bob's daughter. She claims to be, and she is, the first Alateen, right? And she was saying that the people who founded AA were not saintly. You know, and they put their pants on one leg at a time like everybody else. You know, and so many, including myself, I mean, oh, these guys must be like, you know, written in stone. It's like there's nothing that's more holy than whatever. But my eighth step, you know, making a list of people I had harmed, I struggled with that a lot because I knew how abused and how difficult, at different times I'll say I struggled with it. But today I can recognize that I have a role and that I'm the one that's creating whatever. You know, I'm the common denominator no matter where I go. And it's not just because of this person at my job and that person at my, you know, wherever, at a meeting or whatever else. You know, like it says, if I'm disturbed, there's things going on with me and I have to have the humility to be able to own that. That's my only path to freedom. And all amends for me, all amends. They're all about me forgiving myself. Once I learn to forgive myself, I have nothing left to forgive you or anyone else for. That's the truth. All of this to me is a process of me learning how to love myself, and it's a process of me learning to forgive myself and being willing to continue to show up and to learn whatever I need to learn to get to that point. I believe the most important person in this room is standing right here, and I believe the most important person in this room is sitting in all of your seats individually. And if I'm not for me, there's a quote many of you may have heard, but if I'm not for myself, who will be for me? If I'm only for myself, who am I? If not now, when? If I don't take care of me, are you going to do it? I don't think so, right? Can you do it? No. Only I can be in my own corner like no one else. And this process of learning to love myself, this process of learning to forgive myself, I was shamed into thinking that the newcomer is the most important person and everybody's got to focus on them. Well, I did that in my codependence. I mean, boy, just give me that opportunity and I'll be outwardly focused. Because I can't stand being here with me. Doesn't mean the service work, you know, I was talking about motives a moment ago, you know, I believe all motives are mixed. For me, all of my motives are mixed. Like, I mountain bike every day, and I said to my actual sponsor's wife this morning in a test, because I sent him some photos, some pictures, I was like, you know, I know part of it's an escape, part of it's my just escape, but it's also really healthy for me, and I stay fit, and I really enjoy it. And I'm self-employed, so I can get away with it. And I skate ski every day in the winter. You know, it's like for me, I believe if the Big Book was written today, there'd be a whole lot more focus on taking care of ourselves physically, rather than telling us to eat sugar and donuts and drink gallons of coffee and smoke cartons of cigarettes. I mean, that's just, it's just part of the evolution of the consciousness, I think, that's happening as a planet or as people. But anyway. What do I know? So I changed my behavior to liberate myself from within. You know, all of my amends are for myself and to myself. If I'm going to someone to say I'm sorry, to try to get them to forgive me, I'm looking in the wrong direction. If I say something to my mother, like I can see farther now because I'm standing on your shoulders, that's different than going to her and saying I'm sorry, I get so angry so much of the time. For me, amends are changing who I am and how I interact with others. And I do a lot of living amends today. There's a lot of stuff I can't change. And it's not that I haven't said I'm sorry at times, because I have, but I just think for myself, I when I first got here, it seemed like amends were, oh, I need to go make a list of people I need to say I'm sorry to, or pay the money back that I stole, or whatever. Some of that is applicable, but too much of my focus was on that direction, as opposed to recognizing that, you know what, I need to change what I'm doing going forward. The 10th step, you know, I really like, you know, that one line, as I'm sure most people know, you know, when I'm disturbed, there's something when I'm disturbed, there's something going on with me. There's not something wrong with me. There's something going on with me for sure. I mean, I got buttons and they're easily pushed. And if I get triggered, it's on me to be present to it and be awake. And rather than, you know, blame, I'll just say this. This is another thing that I learned, which is really potent and for me has been really helpful. But blame is very absorbent. It dries the tears. Blame is the anti-mourn and hence the anti-self. You know, my family needs to blame me. My siblings to this day still don't talk to me. You know, there was emails going back and forth around, you know, for a few months after my mother passed, around the estate, which my oldest brother handled, and all of us were fine with that. But there's been no further communication. And I think of it all every day, and I know I'm still bargaining. I mean, and I don't obsess about it, but there's never a day that goes by when I don't think about my nieces and nephews. I'll say one of the sad things for me is my younger brother has three kids, and his wife, about 5 years ago, said, just so you know, I just want you to know that those kids keep the card that they get from you for their birthday. Yours is the only card on their bureau all year long. You know, that I could just collapse in tears around that. You know, it's really hard and sad to know that they're growing up, and they used to love when I would come visit. But, you know, that's just part of what I need to feel, because if I want, I could just go get angry and then not feel it. And it's not like, you know, yeah, my life has been my life and I've had my challenges, and I know I'm very aware, so is everybody else's. You know, life is difficult. There's a lot of challenges on this planet. I'm healthy. There's a lot of positives. I've got a ton of friends. I laugh a lot. I've had a lot of things to be grateful for, and I cannot enjoy my life unless and until I can avail myself to the sadness and allow that to pass through and blow through. One thing I'll just share on the 10th step, which has been a tool that really helped me quite a bit, was, you know, I had what was, I'll wrap up here in a sec. I had, you know, a success partner. Like, we would call each other once a week, and we would make a list of the things that we achieved each day during that week. And we would read them to the other person on Saturday morning. And that person would write them down and then feed them back to the one who just read the list with passion, you know. And it was like, it was a tenth step of positives. And the more I focus on those things, the more I do. And the more positives occur. So that was a huge tool for me. And the 11th step, I just want to say, 30 minutes of meditation is necessary, unless I'm really busy. Then an hour is required. That's from one of the daily readers, and it's really true in my life. I've been on 4 silent meditation retreats, 1 3.5 day, 1 4-day, and 1 2 5 days. And I was told, and it's been true for me, that it was really about that. That's confronting myself with a vengeance for real. And I've had so many gifts from meditation. I mean, I sat for 30 minutes today. I like to try to sit for at least 30 minutes. I don't always, but it's a practice. You know, I continually just try to practice. And, you know, when I'm sitting, and you know, a couple of things that help me is I'm not trying to do a chant. I'm not listening to some guided meditation. It's not the sunlit beach or the mountains, if you prefer, like it says in the step book, the AA step book. But for me, it's about putting space between me and my thoughts and learning how to observe my thoughts and kind of not attach to them. So, I mean, I used to be a pinball, bouncing off the world and what you said or did, and also bouncing off my thoughts, you know. Meditation has helped me learn to, you know, ride my horse in the direction it's going, as opposed to, you know, trying to stick my hand in the river and changing the course of the river, you know, which isn't going to happen, right? But putting some space between me and my thoughts has been a huge gift. And there's also been a lot. The first time I ever sat silently in this one retreat, in this very small group, about 10 of us, in a very safe space. I had tears streaming down my face within minutes. I had no idea that was going to happen. One of my teachers says, you know, meditation is about stirring us up. It's not about calming us down. It's like a muddy glass of water, and it like settles when you set it, and clarity presents itself. And for me, that comes up as feelings sometimes, you know. Clarity is being in touch with what's true and what's real. You know, on the 12th step, I talked about being a service junkie and sponsoring people and being a channel. And I guess I'll close, you know, there's so much more I could share, but I will close with saying, you know, my first sponsor, like I mentioned, just celebrated 41 years, and they say to this day, I help others because it makes me feel better. The motivation is selfish. For me, the idea that I drank because I was selfish and self-centered is one of the most toxic sentences I've ever heard in my life, and I used it to whip the shit out of myself and beat myself down in shame. The fact is, if I can help somebody else and feel better in the process, that's awesome. And I do believe more is being revealed, and I do believe that more is constantly being disclosed, and I want to avail myself to that new information. You know, if I'm going to get surgery, I want the doctor that came out of grad school or whatever, their medical school 2 years ago, not the guy that's 50 years old, you know, that didn't learn about all these new procedures. I want to be taken care of by the most current, and I want to avail myself to the most current spiritual, information. At the same time. So, you know, I'm really honored to be here. I'm very grateful to be here. And I just want to say that, you know, you were amazing, 15 years old, to stand up here and share. I'm like, I do not think I could have done this at 15. And I'm very impressed and I'm inspired. And I'm grateful to be a part of recovery with you all. Thanks very much.